Richard Rosenblatt, registration number 15813. I represent the plaintiffs in this matter, who are the appellants in this case. The issue presented by this appeal is whether the district court erred when it found that the plaintiffs, who are retired or eligible to be retired public employees, had no contract right to COLA as part of their pension benefit. And having found no contract right, he then assumed that therefore there was no violation of the contract clause. This is not a case of first impression in Colorado. Though completely ignored by the district court in its analysis, there are two cases decided by the Colorado Supreme Court directly on point, the McPhail case and the Bales case, which are cited in everyone's briefs. In both of these cases, the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that in that case, the city violated the contract clause of the Colorado Constitution by eliminating the type of COLA known as an escalator clause. The reason was that the court found in both of those cases that this was part of the pension that the city could not change for those that retired or were eligible to retire, because once they were in that position of retired or eligible to retire, they were fully vested. And once fully vested, that right could not change in any way. Here, like in McPhail and Bills, as part of its legislation known as Senate Bill 10-001, the state changed the COLA for those who had retired or were eligible to retire. Here, at the time, the COLA was an automatic yearly increase of 3.5%. They changed it to 2% or the CPI, whichever was lower, and then they added that it could be reduced an additional 0.25% if PERA was not at least 99% funded. Like in McPhail and Bills, the change of this fully vested right violated the contract clause. Like I said earlier, remarkably, the district court did not cite, let alone attempt to distinguish McPhail and Bills in finding that COLA was not a fully vested right. Instead, it cited a later Supreme Court case known as DeWitt. The DeWitt case dealt with an insurance contract, and it set part a three-part standard, the first one being whether there was a contract. In DeWitt, they found the contract. In DeWitt, they found no impairment because in that case, that insurance contract, they found no impairment for two reasons. One, because as the court said, the unique nature of an insurance contract, and second, because even though there was a change in who could be the beneficiary, there was no change in what you would receive under the insurance contract, so they found no impairment. The DeWitt case, it must be suggested by the district court, and is suggested, I assume, by the defendants, that DeWitt somehow overruled McPhail and Bills, because that was the only case law that the district court relied on. First of all, in DeWitt, in going to the first element, whether there is a contract, the Supreme Court in DeWitt specifically cited the McPhail decision. Not that it was bad law, but it cited after the proposition that the party had to show whether there was a vested right. Second, subsequent to DeWitt, the Tenth Circuit cited with approval the McPhail and the Bills cases for the point that, and I quote, once an employee retires, a trustee may not adopt an amendment that impairs an employee's vested rights under the plan. Finally, there is an opinion by then State Attorney General Salazar in response to a question from then-State treasurer, and Pear Board member Michael Kaufman. I would point out that the statute specifically makes clear that the Attorney General is the legal advisor to Pear. In this opinion, when questioned, and this opinion came down in 2004, 2 years after DeWitt, in this opinion, when questioned about whether they could make any changes to the pension benefit, Attorney General Salazar relied on the McPhail and Bills decisions and never once mentioned the DeWitt case. Obviously, though, they are now taking a different position in this litigation. At that time, at least, the State Attorney General's office understood that in deciding whether the legislature could constitutionally change the payer benefit, the critical cases for analysis were McPhail and Bills. And as I said earlier, in McPhail and in Bills, in both of those cases, it was dealing with whether, in that case, the city could unilaterally change a COLA benefit, an escalator clause. And they said the answer was they could not for those who were fully vested. As for those, and which were those who were retired or eligible to retire. Here we are dealing with the same class of individuals, those who retired or eligible to retire.
Counsel, pardon me for interrupting. I understand your position is that the DeWitt case has no applicability here, but assume a hypothetical. Let's assume that we believe that it may apply here or does apply here. Can the DeWitt case be reconciled with McPhail and Bills? I hope you will address that.
Yes. Well, in the DeWitt case, they laid out three factors. The first factor being that whether there is a contract, a fully vested right, then whether there is substantial impairment, and third, they raise the reasonable and necessary test as compared to the severity of the impairment. As to the first two tests, the contract and the substantial impairment, we believe that McPhail deals with the same issues. They found that there was a contract. It was substantially impaired. The contract was the fully vested right, so it's completely compatible. So then we get to the third test, and that is the one about the reasonable and necessary as balanced against the severe impairment. First of all, I would point out that the district court never got to this, but more importantly, I don't believe it is our position that in McPhail and Bills, this third element does not apply. And here is why. In McPhail and Bills, the court specifically addressed the question of the difference between fully vested pension rights and partially vested pension rights. And when it discussed partially vested pension rights, it talked about the inchoate rights and that those could be changed if actuarially necessary or if balanced with something else that made it just as good. So it understood that necessary and reasonable test applied to what they described as a limited vested right. But when it came to the fully vested right, they did not apply that test. So at least in Colorado, under McPhail and Bills, that third test does not apply, according to McPhail and Bills.
Of course, they weren't presented with the same set of circumstances. When Justice McWilliams wrote Bills, for example, there wasn't a situation where, for example, the fund was bankrupt or the fund was in dire straits. So you would agree, I take it, that a balancing test would be appropriate if there were circumstances that suggested there was an exigent circumstance.
We would we we would not agree because of McPhailen bills, but if the court decides otherwise, then we would suggest that it needs to be remanded back to the district court to do that balancing test, because that was never done in this case. But the reason we don't agree is they may not have been faced with the same circumstances. The facts as to the state of the fund may have been entirely different. But the fact is, they still addressed in the McPhail and Bills case the whole actuarial necessity defense. They addressed it in that case. It wasn't like they ignored that that test existed. They just addressed it for those who had partially vested right, not for those who had fully vested right.
So, counsel, is it your position then that pensions are somehow different? That pension rights are a different kind of contract right to which this third aspect of the DeWitt case does not apply?
Yes,
it applies to all other contracts, but not pensions.
Well, I don't know that it applies to all other contracts, but at least we know it doesn't apply to pensions in light of McPhailen bills. I can't determine what it is. I would point out that the DeWitt case was the regulation by the state of a private contract between two private parties, whereas the McPhailen bills case was a pension right between the state and the individual. So, I mean, that is a glaring difference in the cases.
But what is it in the text of the contract clauses that would support treating those contracts any differently?
There is nothing in the text of the contract clause itself that would do it. What it is the decision by McPhail and Bills, which made it clear that the actuarial necessity defense only applied in the context of a limited partial vesting.
But those decisions obviously predated DeWitt by decades, and predated U.S. Supreme Court decisions on that point by decades as well. And we have to apply the more recent decisions, don't we?
Well, yes, it definitely predated U.S. Trust, it predated DeWitt. But if you look at that part of the test, that last part of the test in DeWitt, in raising that test, the first case they cite is a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1888, not from sometime after 1961. So in going to the point of the third test, they actually cited a case 70 years before the McPhail and Bills cases, not subsequent to the McPhail. And they say, because of that, they apply that third test. So in DeWitt itself, they relied on case law that was older than McPhail and Bills. And as I said, in McPhail and Bills, they specifically addressed that defense, but only applied it to the one type of right.
Well, let me ask you about that one type of right. In McPhail, the court said that to be vested, the employee had to have either retired or been eligible to be retired. And in Bills, the court applied that, but then went farther, it seems to me. It said that even if you're not even eligible to be retired, you have this limited vesting. My question is hypothetically, what if in that period of time, which can be decades again before you're eligible to retire, the legislative body changes the law on pensions several times, which how do we figure out where the vesting occurs?
The vesting occurs at the time that you are retired or eligible to retire, when you've met the standards of that. That's when the vesting occurs.
But in Bills, there was a class of plaintiffs who were not even eligible to retire, and the court held they had a limited vested right.
Correct.
Okay. That's what I'm confused about. Limited vested right to what? What if you have many changes during a period of decades, and does your right vest in each one of those to the most beneficial one, to the least beneficial one, to the most recent one, to the how do we know?
I'm not sure what the limited vesting right would be to the right to get a pension, but it is potential. It's limited, as I understand those decisions, because it is still subject to change. In fact, here, in this particular case, under Senate Bill 10-001, There were many other changes that the state legislature made besides the one affecting those who were fully vested. There were many affecting those who were, as the Bills and McPhail case said, were partially vested. So it's limited in the sense that it's subject to change if you meet one of the three ways that McPhail and Bill says you can do it: actuarial necessity,
not a substantial impairment,
none, or in that case,
offsetting benefit.
That's correct. Unfortunately, my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Colbert.
May it please the court, Sean Connolly, number 33600, together with my colleague, Sid Riley Posner.
Excuse me, Mr. Rosenblatt. Go ahead, okay. Mr. Connolly.
33600, and together with Riley Posner and Impera's general counsel and interim executive director, Greg Smith. Senior Assistant Attorney General Will Allen has graciously ceded us the state's time as well, although I guess he reserves his right to object if I say something too stupid. The issue here, and it's a narrow issue, and it's a narrow issue decided by the district court. The court ruled on page 12 only, and that's the court's word, only that there is no contract right to a specific COLA formula frozen at retirement for life. This case is not about, as counsel would portray it now, whether there's some freestanding right to some kind of COLA. The COLA is still in effect, and the COLA was misdescribed under SB 1. The COLA now is a 2% fixed COLA, and it's not going to be diminished unless there's negative performance in the para fund, in which it becomes a lesser of 2% or CPI. So it's a similar type formula that existed throughout much of the 90s, in which the COLA was a formula where it could be either 3.5% at that time or CPI, whichever was less. This is a similar type formula. In some ways, it's even stronger in the sense that if there's a positive performance, it's a guaranteed 2%. In any event, the issue is whether, as a matter of contracts clause analysis, there is a specific contract right to this specific COLA formula frozen in life. The district court correctly held that there was not, and correctly held that under Colorado law, statutes are presumed not to create contract rights. The court's ruling is consistent with all Colorado law, including McPhail and Bills cases so heavily relied on by the plaintiffs.
Why didn't the court mention McPhail and Bills? I mean, they seem pretty much on point. The court didn't even try to distinguish them.
The court cited DeWitt for the point that I think we all agreed DeWitt stands for, and it's consistent with McPhail and Bills, is that, and he said under DeWitt, and indeed under all Colorado law, the first issue is there a contract right? And he said there's not. And I think this is different from McPhail and Bills, if I could explain why, Your Honor. There are two critical inquiries under whether a statute creates a contract right. And this is under Colorado law. This is Colorado Springs Firefighters, the Supreme Court, Spradling, this court, U.S. Trust, the Supreme Court of the United States. Factor one is, does the statutory language create a contract? Factor two is, do the circumstances, surrounding circumstances, create a contract?
Well, I interrupt you, Mr. Connolly, but in McPhail and Bills, the court didn't look at either of those factors. It simply asked one question: what was the escalator clause in effect when these people became eligible to retire or retired? That's all they looked at.
Well,
and they said that couldn't be changed. Period. They didn't look at the language of the statute. There's no analysis of that. There's none of the analysis you're talking about in McPhail and Bills.
I believe there is, Your Honor, and I believe they looked at the language of the statute, and they quoted it. And the statute, let's start with the statutory language. It said, a pensioner, a retiree, shall be entitled to this pension.
And here, in our case, it says, it shall receive a COLA, and it shall be 3.5%.
And there's no language of entitlement.
But the language isn't any different than in McPhail and Bills.
I think there is, Your Honor. I think McPhail and Bills is shall be entitled. Here is shall. And I think it's where the language
shall is different than shall be. Shall receive is different than shall be entitled.
I believe that. I think that's a different language. Entitlement. The question is there entitlement here? I think also the language and the function of the COLA and the function of the provision in McPhail and Bills, it was directed at the retiree. It said, and it was in effect for 37 years, which is different than here, unchanged, and everybody had always received it up until the time in 1956 the Denver Council tried to change it. But the language in there was, shall be entitled. It had no function other than a future promise. The language here, which changed 12 times for DPS and 10 times for the pay retirees over the class period, It said, shall, a COLA shall be applied to the base benefit, to the benefit. That's directed at the payer administrator. And that language shall is mandatory because if they said otherwise, if they said there may be a COLA of 3.5%, let's say, then the payer administrator could say, I don't want to give a COLA. If the language, if the legislature wants to create a mandatory COLA for that particular year, they need to use the word shall.
But here it didn't just say shall be a COLA. It said, and it shall be, and gave an amount. The amount is not directed to the payer administrator. It's telling the payer administrator it has to be this amount.
Right.
You have no discretion.
That's right.
It shall.
I think it's directed to a payer legislator and not to a retiree and not to future legislators saying it cannot be changed. If they said that, understand the right that they're asking for. It's a frozen COLA. So Plaintiff Hallis, for example, is a retired state judge, retired in 1999. At the time he retired, the COLA formula was 3.5% or CPI, whichever is less. And that's the COLA formula. He says, I'm entitled to that. I had a contract. I effectively had a handshake contract with the state when I retired, say, that's your COLA for life. Well, what happened? 2 years later, it got better, got 3.5% fixed COLA. He didn't say, nobody said at that time, wait a second, that's different than the contract I wrote. I have a different contract because I retired in 1999 than Plaintiff Hopkins, who retired in 2001, but that is the effect of what they're saying.
But they're not going to complain because it gets better for them.
Well, I think
they're only going to complain when it gets worse.
And they get worse, by the way. They think it worse and they didn't complain in 1994.
It got only theoretically worse. It didn't get actually worse.
The COLA got worse for Plaintiff Hallis. It got better for him in 2011 under the new formula. The new formula gave him a 2% COLA. When he retired in 1999, it was 3.5 or CPI, whichever is less. 1999 happened to be 1.37. So it actually, he's better off now under this COLA. The point of the matter.
For one year.
But the point of the matter is that I don't think, and I don't think there was ever a handshake agreement saying it will never get any worse, it can only get better. If that's their argument, then you're going to have to balkanize every retiree and say, what year did you retire in? What is their COLA fix for life? And the district court simply said, there's no indication that the legislature intended to create a contract. And I think if you look at the two factors, language and circumstances, I tried to suggest that there's a difference in language between McPhail and Bills in this case. I think entitlement does matter. I think shall be entitled suggests a contract promise. But even if the court disagrees with that, there's certainly and indisputably a difference in the circumstances. The circumstances here is that COLA changed more than 10 times over the period. Sometimes better, sometimes worse, sometimes you can't tell until after the fact. And in 1994 is a critical year. In 1994, the legislature did two things. It changed the COLA formula from 4% at that time, 4% non-compounded, to 3.5% compounded or CPI, whichever is less. But at that time, it also took away a very, very important cost of living stabilization funding, a supplemental catch-up COLA. That was taken away from the retirees at that point. Presumably, if there was a contract right, any pre-1994 retiree could have said, I want my supplemental COLA. Don't take that away. Also, there was a...
We're not faced with that. That's nobody's raising that. We're not faced with it. We have to go back to what we're faced with in this case.
No, that's the consequences of their argument, though.
Well, it may be a consequence, but you know, we're the Colorado Court of Appeals. We're not the Colorado Supreme Court. You know, we have to follow Colorado Supreme Court precedent, and I'm just having a very hard time getting around McPhail and Bills. I mean, the language, I don't perceive that there's a difference in language here. On this one question, and let's be clear about this, on the question of whether there's a contract right, the narrow question.
Right.
Okay.
Step one under the analysis.
Now, on these other things that you're talking about, whether they had a reasonable expectation, this is something that the trial court relied on. And it seems to me under the case law, that's part of the second factor, whether there was a substantial impairment. I'm not exactly sure why that is, but it appears that gets analyzed under the second part of the test, not the first part of the test.
I agree with that on the second part, so I think it kind of bleeds very closely into the first part. And let me stick with the first part. I do want to get on to the second and third parts if I need to, but I think we should win this on the first part, and the district court properly resolved this on the first part. I think it is clear, and maybe they can see, that although this wasn't the formulation used in 1959 and 1961, that the existence of a contract right is presumption against it, statutory language presumed not to create one. But the existence of it depends on two factors, and they agree with this, language and circumstances. circumstances. I've tried to argue the language is different, but clearly the circumstances are different. In Bills and McPhail, there was a 37-year unbroken period in which this clause had been applied, and the salary was based on the existing salary of the current occupant of the retiree's position, unbroken for 37 years. That's not the case here.
But it would give me more comfort if the court had actually relied on that fact. There's no indication in McPhail and Bills that that was part of their analysis at all. They didn't even mention it. After noting what the law had been, there was no mention of that in the analysis.
The first time that analysis was raised explicitly was in U.S. Trust in 1977, as Your Honor noted, decades after McPhail and Bills. But we know the analysis applies in not only in the U.S. Contracts Clause, which is indistinguishable from the Colorado Contracts Clause, we know it applies under Colorado law because the Supreme Court has said that. The Supreme Court has said that in Colorado Springs Firefighter, in which there was a promise. The promise there was you will receive medical benefits for your lifetime. Will receive, shall receive, I don't think there's a lot of difference. There's no language entitlement, but will receive. And the Supreme Court said that language is not sufficient to show a promise. We presume against promises, and you fail step one. And that was in Colorado Springs Firefighters. That was relied on in Spradley, when this court said, the language said, there shall be an exemption of pensions, a disability pension, shall be an exemption for disability pension from state taxation. 1989, that changed. Spradley said, that's okay, that's not a promise. We presume that's not a promise. Shall language still shall be an exemption, but they said you can change that because that's not a promise. We presume that legislatures make laws, not contracts. So I think you're right in the sense that they didn't say there's a two-step inquiry, we look at language and circumstances. I think in reading them, that's very harmonious with that because I think the language and circumstances in McPhail and Bills both point to a contract right. I think the language and circumstances here both point against it. But I think that test is similar to the test, and there's no dispute. The plaintiffs agree that's the test. That's a U.S. trust test, and then it's since been adopted by the Colorado Supreme Court and Colorado Springs Firefighters and by this court in Spradling. So there's no dispute that two-part test applies. I think the trick here is to reconcile McPhail and Bills with that two-part test, and I don't think that's particularly hard, because I think if we look at the language, shall be entitled, I think if we look at the consistent circumstances in 37-year unbroken history, they meet it both. So I think that I would ask the court to, like the district court did, stop this as step one of the inquiry, which everybody agrees applies. If we go beyond that, if the court finds or assumes arguendo that there's some kind of contract right to a specific COLA formula, again, that's what they're claiming, not simply to some kind of COLA, they still have a COLA, to a specific frozen contract formula, then the question is there a substantial impairment and is there a reasonable necessary to do so? I think we easily satisfy those, but before I get to that, if I could just say why I think that test fully applies. They try to say McPhail and Bills froze the law of contracts clause case law in 1959 and 1961. I think McPhail and Bills, there was no argument made in that case that we need to do these. These were self-funded pensions, and they were in the control of the Denver City Council. Denver City Council, if they didn't want pensions to go up, simply could say, we don't want current salary of officers to go up. So they were able to control both the current salaries and the escalator clause. What they couldn't do, the court said, given a promise that made to retirees that you're always going to be entitled to the same pay of your current occupant or position, what they couldn't do was divorce the two and just give a raise to current employees and divorce that and not give that same benefit to the retirees. There was no argument in that case that this was not a substantial impairment of a contract right. There was no argument in that case that this was actuarially necessary. In fact, the latter test really had not come into clarity at that time, and therefore we think that Bills and McPhail, to the extent you have to go to steps two or three, can be reconciled with this case in the sense that they wouldn't have met, Denver could not have met steps two or three, and even though those steps didn't apply at that time, there was no need for the court to go further.
Well, it's assuming that we have to look at steps two and three, why don't we need to remand to the trial court to make factual findings, which it didn't make? I'm having difficulty with your argument that we can make those findings as a matter of law, because, you know, we don't make findings at the Court of Appeals.
Understood, Your Honor. I don't think they're factual findings. I think that this is that these are issues of law. I think whatever the court were to say in that on those factors would be reviewed de novo in this court. So I think this court could review them in the first instance and decide them in the first instance, because I think they're really...
Well, how can we decide whether there's actuarial necessity based on this record?
I think one way you can do it is not challenged. We argued, and you know, we defended the judgment on two grounds, on the ground the court actually reached, which I'm very comfortable defending on, and then also, if you have to go further than that there's actuarial necessity. They've never challenged that. They had not challenged actuarial necessity. In their reply brief, they didn't say, no, it's not necessary. They cut it off and said, no, you can't get there. They said, as a matter of law, that's not relevant.
Is there some sort of a stipulation in the trial court that we could rely on that there's actual, that the plaintiffs have agreed there's actuarial necessity?
No, I think they forfeited that argument by not raising it here. They simply said, I think when we say there's actuarial necessity, it's a question that can be reached de novo, and they come back and say, no, we can't get there because that's not a relevant inquiry. I think if they want to preserve the argument, they should go further. So I suggest they forfeited by not arguing that, in fact, there was no actuarial necessity. They simply said that's not relevant on McPhails and Bills. That's the end of the inquiry.
By not arguing it here or in the district court?
Here. And in the district court, their arguments were not particularly strong.
But why would they argue it here? There's no ruling on that point here for them to appeal. There's only a ruling on the one first step issue. Is there a vested contract right? That's all. So there's nothing else for them to appeal. How can they raise an argument on something that hasn't been ruled on?
Well, we're entitled to defend it on other grounds.
But why did they have to raise it? You're saying they forfeited it.
Well, I think when we raise it, they have to be more than say it's not a proper issue. I think they have to say it doesn't exist. But in any event, I think it clearly does exist. And I think the very fact that they've appealed this solely in McPhails and Bills, and I think that's where they pin their hats. And I think that's why, in fact, they did not appeal similar rulings in South Dakota and Minnesota, where the courts rejected identical claims. So for those reasons, unless there are any further questions, we ask the court to affirm the district court on step one, and if necessary, on steps two and three. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connolly. Thank you again, Mr. Rosenblatt. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.